Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Well, welcome to the Angus Table again. My name's Scott Wright, the CEO of Angus Australia, and we're blessed this morning to have Simon Irwin, the CEO of Beef Australia, along. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks very much, Scott. Great to see you here.
Simon, we've become friends, really, over this last bit of time. Listeners would be interested to know, and my daughter's actually just completed a degree at Rockhampton at Central Queensland Uni, and when she was coming up here, I actually knocked on the door of Simon. I said, oh, could we come and have a bit of a chat? Angus Australia has always supported Beef Australia, and I came up. He said, well, why don't I give you a lap of the university and show you the research facilities, and introduce me to a number of academics doing good ag research up here. So, and then since then, it's been a progression, and we get on quite well. So, yeah.
It's been great, and it was wonderful to see you caught me graduate yesterday. It was, as parents, it's a wonderful moment.
That's right. Absolutely. That's right. The world stops for 5 minutes, doesn't
it?
Does. Yeah. Simon, I've got to know you, but you've had an interesting career, Simon. Well, tell us a little bit. You started as a stock agent, didn't you? How did your career progress?
Well, I was born and bred Warwick, and our family business was the newspaper business. So I started at uni studying journalism. That didn't finish. I left and became a stock agent. Started as the mail boy in Brisbane with ML Estates, and then Elders AML Estates, Elders Pastoral, and had the opportunity to work around Queensland. So Wallumbilla, St George, Mitchell, Roma, Richmond up north. Found a wife in Richmond, so I got takeaway, which was good. And so after that, felt we need to do some formal education. So I left Elders, as it was then, and got a job at the Gladstone Observer, but in advertising, not in journalism. And from there, progressed through until I was executive GM for News Corp, looking after all their regional publications. And they went from Hobart to Port Douglas and Darwin and Alice Springs, so fairly big remit. And did that for the best part of 30-odd years until that change in industry happened. And they shut most of the regional papers and didn't need me. So I spent time as a house husband. Bathrooms never looked better. And then the opportunity came up with the beef job. And for me, it brought together a lot of strands of life. So from the cattle auctioneer background, and then marketing and management, and dealing with a lot of politicians and things like that. So, yeah, it all came together, and really enjoyed the challenge of beef.
Oh, that's excellent, Simon. And you had a little bit of time on the north coast of New South Wales, didn't you, I believe?
Yeah, I was a regional manager out of Lismore. Lived on the north ridge at Canelabo, looking out at the nightcaps. And then moved to Rocking 21 years ago. And I think even though you're with the same company, and a multitude of jobs within that job. So they had a wonderful look around. Gee whiz, it's wonderful to see the commonalities between regions. And I think with all regional communities, there's more that makes them alike than keeps them separate.
Yeah, we've had a couple of days up here, and we actually have quite a bit of time because of family reasons up in Rocky. It's a beautiful community, isn't it? It's a wonderful town.
People always say, oh, it's so hot in Rockhampton. It's so cold in Warwick and Toowoomba and Gara. For instance, or snow in Armidale. So everywhere can be testing for 3 months of the year. And sure, it gets warm and rocky, but we don't have a winter. And it's a bit like the Northern Territory now. In the winter, there's something on every weekend, and it's getting really busy. And people, so you'll have had it. Same in New South Wales. So why don't you go to Sydney? Or asked over the years, why don't you live in Brisbane? Well, If I lived in Brisbane, it would be just more things that I don't have time to get to, because I can't get to everything that I'd like to do in this region. Why increase the non-attendance by a factor of 10?
got to say, I've got to testify to the friendliness of Rockhampton as I walked down the street yesterday and around and through the hotel. It's a very friendly community, and you don't go very far and you're just talking to a complete stranger, which was really, really nice. Simon, tell us a bit about Beef Australia. Can you give us a snapshot history of beef? How did it go from obscurity to, you know, the premier really agricultural event, perhaps in the Southern Hemisphere, or that might be a big call, but yeah, give us some of the history, Simon.
Well, it started as an idea of some locals for their bicentennial in 1988, so looking for what was the cattle industry in those days going to do as their part in the celebration for the bicentenary, and Beef 88 was developed from that. And it was, you know, a lot of cattle in the street, and it was a dinner, and it was competitions and some trade shows, and it kind of grew from there. And then it was so successful that they did it again in 91 and then 94, and it's just kept going. And I think as the beef industry, well, if you've been trying to get it going in the early 70s when the cattle depression was on, it lasted a week, let alone 40-odd years. And I think the timing was right. And I think the other thing that's helped beef is that three-year interval. And there's always a reason to go back. And to be frank, if something's on every year, you tend to say, oh, I went last year, I can't be bothered going this year. And the pace of change in technology and markets means it's always, there's always something that you can come back for. Over the years, it's gone from being a committee to now a very formal structure. We have a board, a volunteer board, but now the board, we are big enough that it's about corporate governance and strategy rather than driving steel posts and putting the bunting up. And so that has enabled us to really get proper guidance from a group of very experienced people who aren't then worried about, does the tab work?
Yes.
And so that's been a major change. And you know, we're still going through it, but I think that's made it, and in some ways, an easier organisation. We're more professional.
And you've got a Angus director now, Simon, Wendy Main from Texas. That's nice for our breed to have some input into that. How did that come about, Simon?
You're actually nominate, and it's an election. Board. We have an election after every event, so it's every 3 years, and we have four directors. Right, we have 11, so you basically sign up for a 10-year stint, which is still only three events. So, the first one you're learning, the second one it just gets easier. And Wendy was successful. Interestingly, people still think of it as Rockhampton Beef Week, but we have more directors in New South Wales now than we do who live in Rockhampton. So we have Jess Webb down outside of Armidale, and Kay Becker has moved down there. She's at Gyra now. So we've got Warrior, the Gyra and Armidale. So it's starting to get that more national
feel to it. Yeah, that's great. I thought after the World Angus Forum, and Wendy was involved in our World Angus Forum organising committee, that she might have PTSD, but just put her hand up a second time. Yeah. So that's an encouragement to our members.
To have people from, so beef, one of the changes over the years has been taking it from something about the beef industry to the beef community. And so if you are living in a town with an abattoir, the beef community there is more than just the people who breed or shift cattle or do that. So we've broadened it out, and I think it's really important that we keep in touch with the fact that it's still all about the cattle.
Yep.
And so having a very successful breeder like Wendy, and you had to see the results of the Texas Angus sale this year, it just gives us some depth of knowledge. And so we're really lucky that we've got people, commercial cattle people, who are solicitors, people who are in finance, people who are very large corporate ag. And so, it's a good mix.
That's great. In terms of the scope of beef, Simon, how far afield do people come from, and what parts of the industry do they come from?
They come from the globe now. So we had people from 34 countries last time attend, and they're the people we know attend. So We have an international program. We ask people
to register.
But there's no requirement in South Africa. Just front up and pay the $10 and go and have a look around. But we had 7,000 tickets go to an international address. So
that's a lot of people. 7,000. That's a lot of internationals.
And the only thing that holds you back in a place and in any regional centre is accommodation. So if I could find another 1,000 rooms, we'd have another 1,000 international visitors.
Amazing.
We had we have an MOU with Agrivision, which is beef in Canada.
Basically. Yes.
They're annual, and it was great to see their team come out. I've been over and we've had people go over, and it's a real exchange of ideas because you're in no way, shape or form a competitor because you're 14 hours by aeroplane or 17 hours by aeroplane apart. So it's good just to have them dealing with exactly the same things we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that from beef point of view, we are of the industry, not really in the industry.
Yep.
So we are, I get phone calls all the time wanting comments on lumpy skin disease and tariffs and things like that. I always explain that's not what we do. We are exposition, not MLA or
yes.
the Angus Society or something, which we try never to pretend to be. But when you've got Beef Australia, it's probably the best brand name in Australia. And yeah, you get phone calls saying, I'd like to get meat into Malaysia. Yeah, what do I do?
Yeah.
Bring someone who knows.
Yeah.
It's about the answer.
Well, I often have those same phone calls. That's the one. But it is, yeah, the CEO of Beef Australia probably does seem to some people like you're the guy in charge of the industry.
Yeah, yep. It doesn't work at home, Scott. I don't know how that Angus by Mullicks, but it doesn't work at home.
That's great. No, that's great. It's a cultural melting point, really, isn't it, for the whole industry. What do you think beef producers support it so strongly, Simon?
I think there's always something new, but apart from anything else, and we've kind of woken up to it as a country now, but that social connection is a really important part of beef. So you can go there, you can learn this, you can see genetics in action, you can see the latest tech, you can see all this stuff, but also you can catch up with people that you might only run into once every 3 years. And I think it's that balance of trying to bring city and country together.
Mm-hmm.
It's also an opportunity for our major partners to actually get so many of their clients in the one spot. And I think that really helps it too. For people who have not been to a beef event, the corporate presence is unbelievable.
It's wall to wall, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And say you've got 8 or 10 banks. You had last time we had Pilatus. So there's the cattle industry is strong enough that a Swiss aircraft manufacturer
yes.
thought it was worthwhile putting up a not inconsiderable structure and reports sold aeroplanes. So it's, I think, that depth in the beef industry. But we still want the person that's working in the boning room at Blake's Creek or the Narimba to come along
yes.
and enjoy it. And it's also about tasting beef. And we try and make sure in Meat Street, where all our food vans, well, not all, but lots of the food vans are, really offer that you can come back every night with your family and try beef a different way.
That's excellent, yeah. Well, no, I just recorded a podcast recently with Tony Perrott, the Minister for Primary Industries up here, and he said to me that he's been coming since 91, I think, and has a standing room at the Criterion. I said, why do you stay there? And he said, well, that's where everybody is in the beef industry. So, yeah, it's certainly a wonderful melting pot. You always seem to get a Prime Minister up here too, Simon. How do you go both sides of politics to manage to get the PM?
Oh, we're agnostic. So we love having them come up. And beef's one of those things where both sides of politics have always been strong supporters of it. And I think it's because our focus is on industry education, it's on international business. Yeah, that's of a great appeal to politicians of all persuasions. And you mentioned Tony Perrott before. When David Crisafulli, Premier, gave him his letter of appointment, a successful Beef 2027 is one of Tony Perrott's KPIs. So the government think enough of it. And it's a big investment. Mm. We get funding from governments, and it couldn't happen without that, because you can't. It's like putting something like Tamworth or an Armadale. If it's going to be really big and global, you've got to build stuff, because there's nowhere really. And yeah, arguably you could probably have enough covered stuff at the Brisbane Convention Centre, but then people aren't going to be happy with 2,000 cattle parked on Musgrave Park or something. So
yes, yeah,
you know, it's a regional event in the beef capital. That's, yeah, more of the Australian cattle herd within 200 k's of here than anywhere else, I think. And so it feels right, and Rocky does support it, but Polly's just love coming along. And
excellent.
Tony's wonderful for now. He takes no looking after at all.
Yeah.
He's a cattleman himself, so he needs to be seen through the door, shaking hands, and you don't see him for 5 days, because he's out talking to everybody he knows. And
that's wonderful. That's great. How many people do you get through, Simon?
120,000, and that equates to about 50,000 souls. So people come through multiple times. We don't know what it could be, because anybody who's trying to get accommodation for beef now will figure out that you're waiting for someone to drop out. So motels are booked out. We book out the Capricorn Coast, Yeppoon down that way. We use Gladstone. We have tent cities. We have...
Yep.
Yeah. So we're always exploring new ways of trying to accommodate people. And one of the great hopes for Rocky, of course, with the Olympic rowing in 32, would be that the athlete's village may be something, if that's 600 rooms, if somehow that can be used for industry events and Rocky mats and all the other stuff that goes on, that'd really help.
That'd be very positive.
Yeah.
Do you have any sort of feeling for what percentage of the beef industry make their way here? I think I spoke to John Cornan recently. He said, look, they estimate about 50,000 beef producers in Australia. Have you been able to work out what percentage of beef producers come along? I'd imagine it'd be pretty substantial.
I think it is. Yeah, and it's amazing. Well, it's, and I think it's, since we run three competitions, we have a carcass comp, commercial comp, and the stud cattle comp. So for our carcass comp last year, we had entries from every state. And so that national part of it gives you a connection. So we get people from Perth, we get people from Tasmania, the seventh state across the water over.
Yes.
In New Zealand, we get quite a number of them coming through.
Glad we can quote you on that. We've got some New Zealand members. That's great. Thanks, Simon.
Yeah, I think it is in the Constitution. They can come on board when they want.
It is. It is. You're the only person other than me that's been game to mention that to the Kiwis, so thank you.
So I think it is still a beef event. But since we try and balance the trade chain, there is something that if you're in beef but your partner or someone isn't, there's still something for them to do.
Yeah, very much so.
We try and balance that menu so that there's some education stuff, there's some enjoyment stuff, there's some industry events, there's, you can go and talk to the Angus Society, or you can go and talk to a bank, or you can talk to that. So it's also about commercial outcomes. And one of the changes I'm making in 27, next event, we measure the economic impact of beef in a formal economic impact study, and it delivered $110 million into central Queensland and about another 70 into the broader Queensland economy. What we don't know is what business was done.
Yes.
So that's just people having accommodation, getting here, flights, all that sort of stuff. It's $110 million. So, and that's what we spend putting it on. And so we can measure all those things, but what we don't know is, from your members' point of view, how many of them sold bulls or exported genetics. So we will be asking everybody this time around to supply that number to a third party. We will put on a major accounting firm to ask people, because I have no interest at all in the individual numbers, but that bottom right-hand corner of the spreadsheet, I'd really love to know.
Yeah, that's important for your investors, like the federal government, the state government.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So that's, Is it 250 million? Is it half a billion? Is it a billion? Who knows?
And yes. So
when you have sponsors like LAWD who are dealing in major property deals, if you sell two places in the territory as a result of peak meetings, you have it. But there's 400 million in all probability. So the numbers can be huge. So we're really keen to find that out.
I find it incredible that when I'm here, Simon, that we're so far north, halfway up the Queensland coast, and I'd see more of my Angus members from the south at Leith than I do at a southern event. Quite incredible, the distance people are actually coming to attend. Now, Simon, you've got a huge matrix of events here. Normally you go to a major event like this and there'll be a gala dinner. I think you've got a run of them, don't you, Simon, and breakfasts and the events. What's the scale of those associated events?
Oh, that's huge. And our catering is a major job. So we start working on that now. And if you've got a sponsor for a dinner, then we're agreeing menus and packages and all those sorts of who speaks. But there's certainly breakfast, lunch and dinner is pretty much the way it goes.
Mm.
And then seminars. One of the things we're working on for this event is an app to make it easier for people to get around, because if people have been there, it's a very large event, even though the footprint's not big enough. If you're up one corner and you're going down to the other one, and then you're trying to get there in a hurry and you're getting tied up by the tongue, meeting people you haven't seen for 5 years, you can miss stuff. So we try and make it easier to let people plan their itineraries. The other thing we'd like to do for people who haven't been before is suggest stuff. So if you're interested in genetics, go and have a look at this. If you're interested in carbon and tech, then these things may be of interest to you. So we can pre-populate people's menus, what they want to do during the week. But if you don't have enough functions, it's not for sprinters.
Yes. It's a marathon week, isn't it?
It's a marathon week, and people would see us sitting together. We both don't mind a steak. I tell you what, I fed a fish fingers on a Sunday night. It's not even a question anyway. I was putting this thing on. Couldn't face them.
Got the meat sweats, yeah.
Got the meat sweats, absolutely.
That's great. That's great. People mightn't realise, but Beef Australia was very helpful to Angus Australia. And when we started to plan the World Angus Forum, and that was, I don't think there was anything that your organisation weren't helpful with. We had a couple of people come up and spend a bit of time just for some learnings in the early stages, which we're very appreciative of. And I'd like to thank Beef Australia for that willingness, Simon. It was excellent. Through that, I had a bit of a sneak peek too. You've got a lot of planning going on. The spreadsheets, the Gantt charts, I love the fact when you walk in the door of the office here, it's got a big sign, so many days to go, that you change every day. Yeah, what actually goes on there, Simon? How do you give the listeners a snapshot of the intensity of planning?
Yeah, we're trying to, I think what we've done in a couple of events I've been here is trying to bring the planning forward, because it's a bit like parachuting. I think you float around for a long time and then suddenly the ground's coming up at you.
Yeah.
So we try and we moved everything a bit further forward to enable us to finesse stuff and give everybody else enough time to plan their part of Beef, because it is for people who are coming here, for instance, it's a big investment. We are confident that it gets you a return, but we'll try to make that process as easy as we can. Really does help. So we have a structure where we have event managers who organise content, which is from entertainment through to dinners. We then have ops who organise security and building tents and structures. We have a partnerships department. We have marketing and comms. So we work very hard to let people know what's going on. And that really helps too. We've got a finance department. And we've split out this time. I've got Bonnie Geddes on as a livestock manager, because our event manager looked after all those things last time, and it's too much. And you do need specialist knowledge to be able to keep the cattle as what it's all about. So Bonnie's doing that for us. She's been on for a while now. And then we have a meeting every week where we use that as an opportunity to make sure we haven't missed anything. So just because you're the partnership manager doesn't mean you're going to not miss. So, we'll ask our ops manager to say, well, what about this? Or the same the other way back, should we face that tent this way because the noise will affect some of our partners who are trying to have their own things on and their structures at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we try and do it as a communal effort, but there's too much. So you still have people who are going down various roles trying to make sure it all comes to you. And you've had the same thing with the forum.
No, very, very hard. I guess you've got a lot of accumulated intellectual property in the area. We had to build the Boskala as we ran a bit, Simon.
Well, I think one of the things, last event was the first one, and it was all its foresight, but we traditionally, everybody's contract finished a month after me, and so you'd be left with two people, but you're also left with no IP. So we've changed the structure so that your five or six core people stay on between events, and that's why we can bring some of the planning forward, because it streamlines the workflow so that you don't just have peaks and troughs. And I think that will enable us to put a better event on, because you're not riding that bicycle into the same pothole every time you do it. And there are things we have mucked up year after year. And sometimes you end up with learning hard lessons. Like, I know more about portable toilets after the last event than I ever aspired to. And it came down, we got to the cattle camping, and we got what we thought were the flashiest public toilet, portable toilets that you could ever get. And you use this special capsule and you chuck it in, that makes all the evil spirits go away. And by the Monday, they stink like some third class train on the subcontinent, and you just couldn't believe how bad they were. So I'm running around giving a gob full to people and saying, how can this be? And everybody's saying, we're doing it, this, I don't know what's wrong. It turned out that the tablet you throw in, I'm sure many of your members have a dishwasher at home,
yes,
and when you chuck the tablet in the dishwasher, you don't have to take it out of the packet. But with these three toilets, you've got to take them out of the plastic packet, so we might as well have been chucking pebbles in.
Yeah, right.
Once someone figured out that you've got to take the pellet out,
it was fine.
All the evil spirits went away.
It's amazing.
So just stuff like that. And you think, how can that happen? Well, I can assure you
it can. Yeah, and becomes a major issue, doesn't it?
And you wouldn't want them. And what we're trying to do for people who did come to beef, particularly cattle, is the cattle camping. Nearly walked apart from stinky bears and not enough water pressure in the beginning. So we fixed a lot of that up. Wherever possible, we'll keep that in the same spot. So people, we know that we need buses to move people to start earlier. We know that more showers will be better off here. But I think if we can keep it as much similar to last time, that'll make it easier for everybody. Because, people are bringing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of seed stock. I've got enough to worry about without trying to find a toilet that doesn't smell like Glastonbury.
I now have a vision of you watching that film, that Australian classic, Kenny, for a few learnings.
It's just unbelievable.
So, that sort of raises a point, and about how do you handle the pressure personally. It's how many staff would you have in your employment by the time... What's it fluctuate from now through to?
For now, we've probably got 8, and a couple of those are remote where possible. There are jobs that we actually need here in the office. But for instance, Joyce, our finance manager's down on the Sunshine Coast. Amy, who's putting together the ops program, she's in Brisbane. But that's where most of the suppliers are.
Yes.
So that kind of works. But if you're in comms and marketing, then we need
you.
And so we try and look at it as that. It builds up to, if you're taking in casual staff and things like that, halfway to 100,
That's a lot of people.
A lot that we pay. But some of that's only for a fortnight.
Yep.
The other thing we do is not try and think we need to have everybody in-house. So we have worked now, last event, with some people who are really good at what they do. So I kind of look that we don't need to be the experts at everything. So for event control and things, you know, security and traffic management and things like that, we don't actually need to have someone who can do the CAD for that here. You know, there are lots of people around. So we tend to work a little bit more that way now.
Okay.
Which opens up a lot of opportunities for everybody else. We do have we try wherever possible to have locals first, and that's A, because it's the right thing to do, and B, because if you live in Rocky, we don't have to find you a room.
Yeah.
And so the more locals we use, it leaves more accommodation for visitors.
For guests, yes.
Rather than for us choking them up with staff.
To be a little personal, Simon, how extreme is the pressure for you personally?
Well, I've been lucky enough to be surrounded by people who know what they're doing. And so from that point of view, I'd be lying if I said you weren't on edge for the week and in the lead up to it. But you know, plan the work the plan. We just try and make sure it's as much organised as possible. Where the pressure came on for me last time is 12 mils of rain.
Yes.
And your crown drops and everything else drops as a cause of it. But the size of the capital infrastructure we put in the hand lab, you look around, it's a sea of mud, and you think, how can that little rain cause this? But there's no guttering on a tent.
Yep.
And say 12 mils of rain's 1.8 megalitres of runoff when you get the calculator out. So it doesn't take a lot falling in between tents before you're looking at a morass. And so that's when the pressure comes on. But for most of it, it's really important, but we're not feeding the world, or as your daughter qualifying as a paramedic, you know, we're not.
Yes. Yeah.
We're not saving lives, so I think you've got to keep that in perspective.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And with the rain example, it's a very dry time of year up here in Rockhampton. It's a beautiful time of year, May, to run an event like this. So it's, if you did a risk analysis, you would think that wasn't it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
But it's a very stressful job. Big budget. How do you yourself find a bit of refreshment in amongst the planning for the next, I guess it's, 18 months now to the next event? How do you switch off, Simon?
Well, I'm lucky in so much that we've got a little prickle farm, a little lock out the back of Gracemere, and it's nice to get out there. A good collection of friends. A bit of tennis, a bit of rowing, all that sort of thing. No good being in Rockhampton if you don't row now. So you just try and look after that part of life. It's great being able to relax. But I was pretty lucky in a corporate career where the media industry, particularly newspapers, were in decline for 15 or 20 years. So much of my managing back in those days was actually being the bearer of bad news.
Yeah, right.
And
yep.
So to work in something that most people are really happy to be a part of is pretty easy. You know, we are not explaining why you have to come to beef to most people. People know what it is. And so that's really nice.
That's great. That's great. Now, yesterday, Simon, you were asked to do the commencement speech at University of Central Queensland's graduation. You spoke about a couple of things. It was a really great speech, and I think everyone really was engaged with it. You talked about when you're working, getting ready for change and change being normal. And I guess you've experienced it more in your career than perhaps some others, but we all there. And then you spoke about bringing an X factor to what you bring to your role or job or work. Yeah, do you want to flesh that out a little bit? Stuck with me, actually, Simon. I typed some notes in the phone while you were speaking.
Thank you for that. I did suffer a bit from imposter syndrome giving that address yesterday, because the last graduation I was at was my daughter Sally's down at UNE in Armidale, and the bloke who gave the speech down there was a Nobel laureate who discovered 70% of the universe. So me as an ex-stock agent wandering out did feel a little under spec'd. But the message I tried to give to graduates, which you can do looking back on a career, was that your competitors for a job used to be the people who were beside you at graduation. Now your competitors are around the globe. And more importantly, your competitors may well not exist in a human form. And AI is not only an increasing competitor, it's a competitor whose skills get exponentially better every month. So if you are going to be in employment, you have to bring the human part of you to work. And it's what of you do you bring to work? And I was conscious of not sounding like your classic boomer that you have to do 60 hours a week and 20 of it unpaid. That wasn't the message. But the message is, you know, join the social club, join the workplace health and safety thing, you know, organise the Christmas party, help the new person pack the dishwasher, doesn't matter. But also the stuff. So if you've got people who are involved in surf lifesaving, or they volunteer at the gallery, or they do all those sorts of things and are citizens, that's what we want here. Because if I wanted robots here, you can get robots. And so we choose not to use AI here for a variety of reasons, but one of it is our industry, as in the beef community, is still a one-on-one human contact industry. And yeah, I think people need to prepare for that. And so understanding you as a human, I think, really important for the employer.
I think that's a good point. We're also a people business. We're essentially an Angus cattle business, but it's all about the people, really. I'm a frustrated journalist. I'd write a few things for our members at times. And what I have noticed, interestingly, is with this increasing use of AI, and I'm interested you brought that up, is that when people, and you'll notice different individuals use it quite heavily in their work or their emails, it loses the X factor, I think. I think there's one thing AI can't do is push the boundaries of creativity, and I don't think it'll ever do that. I think it's always copying and learning from others, but yeah, it was an interesting comment that you made.
I think I have a bit of an issue with that overthinking things, which my wife would somehow can be prone to. The AI companies have gone out, stolen a heap of people's work, put it through machine learning, and now using it to compete against the very people whose work they stole in the beginning. So as employers, we're signing forms saying we're making sure we're not dealing with people who have slavery, that we do all these things. To me, the stuff's just unethical.
Yes.
Different if you've got a large learning model and you're using your own data and you're crunching numbers. Like, that makes sense. But if you're saying, write me 500 words in the style of a Pulitzer Prize winner to this, and you're dealing in stolen goods, I know that probably sounds over the top, but yeah, I think we need to bear in mind where some of this stuff comes from.
It's a good point. I think for years we were conscious of plagiarism and not stealing intellectual property, and then we've endorsed it as a society.
It's gone down that road.
So it's a pretty, it's probably too deep for this podcast, but it's a good point for all of us, I think, in this industry to think about. Yeah, Simon, when you look back on your career, any great mentors that have helped you on your journey?
Yeah, there have been, and some of those were early on bosses of where I was working that gave me the opportunity to understand what was going on behind the numbers. And I think having those people who give you a deeper understanding then lets you progress. And I think that's been good. I also, as a newspaper family in my early career in the media, my father was in it, my brother was in it. So we had that sort of collective approach to how you did it. But I think you learn, I always said, God gave you one mouth and two ears, so if you listen twice as much as you talk, you'll learn stuff. And I think working as an ad rep, which sounds really unglamorous and hardly exists now, but you'd go to sell an ad to a car dealer, and then to a curtain shop, and then to a pool shop, and then to a church. And so to be able to put something together for them you have to understand their business. And we have two other employees here have backgrounds in media sales. And I think it's that generalist understanding and why businesses work really help.
That's interesting. You must, being a journalist, you must read a lot as well, although you could be over it. But any great books, any must-reads, Simon?
I think they change so much. Like the stuff that I was brought up on, I always remember as a young manager, the CEO would say, read In Search of Excellence, and half those companies don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And so I think you've got to keep up with it. I really enjoy some of the stuff like Simon Winchester, who's written things on the history of Krakatoa and just odd things. I think it's really important to keep that generalist view. I subscribe to a number of online newspapers from the Courier Mail and the News Corp ones, from the Sydney Morning Herald, the Country Life. I read The Guardian, and I think what that does is give you a balance between, if you only get stuck in the one bubble, your algorithm and your Facebook will just keep serving you more of the same. So I think it's really important to trick the algorithm by, looking at stuff that's a bit different, so you can't be pigeonholed. And I think it's that broad media
philosophy.
Yeah, it really helps, because otherwise you just get stuck in a rut.
It's an interesting one. I always read the Sydney Morning Herald because I thought it was the most balanced newspaper in Australia. And more recently I found exactly something similar, that you've got the News Corp type of approach, which is quite right conservative leaning, I guess. But I've never actually, you're the first bloke that said that they read that and The Guardian. So that's a good mix.
If you're going to read the right, you've got to read the left.
Yeah.
I don't feel that they're tricking me. Mm-hmm. So if I was looking for great praise at Anthony Albanese, I wouldn't necessarily go to the Courier Mail to find it.
Yes.
Nor would I go to The Guardian to find out that Peter Dutton wasn't a bad bloke after all. Like, you are unlikely to get that. But as long as you know where they're coming from, I think, even though people might agree with it, if it's a known bias, then that's fine. It's the ones who pretend not to be biased who are, I think there's an ethical question out of some of those. But the rest of it, you know where they're coming from.
That's great.
I believe half of it.
Well, I hope we always get a little gem in our podcast, and I think listeners have just got the gem for this episode, so that's good. What would be, always ask this one, what's the best beef eating experience that you can remember?
Oh, that is a good one. I've enjoyed a lot, but one of the most memorable would have been as a young bloke helping with a bush kill and taking the skirt off and chucking it on a barbecue.
Interesting.
It was memorable.
Yeah.
The things that stick with you. I love a bit of rump.
It's a great cut, more flavour than others. It's beautiful.
Yep. Right. And you can, with the ink, marbling for me can go, I think some cuts are best enjoying the way the Japanese do.
Yes.
And if there's too much marbling and you end up trying to eat 400 grams of it, then I find that a bit difficult.
Yes.
But I think it's wonderful in its place. But it's funny, the stuff that if I think about what I... if you've been away, and particularly when my office was in Brisbane, so you'd be there and you'd be going to functions and you're visiting this and having dinners and doing all that. Sunday night, savoury mince on toast.
That's wonderful.
It still takes a bit of beating.
I can really concur with that. I actually am probably, you're the same. We're blessed to eat a lot of beef in our jobs and careers. You've travelled a lot. I travel a lot, and I do enjoy coming home and having sausages.
Absolutely. But we call it, the kids grew up with snog, which was sausages and onion gravy. And it's still, I particularly enjoy a Sunday night feed of that, because then I get lunch for work for Monday and Tuesday as well.
Yes. So
it has a double purpose.
That's great. Now, getting a bit to the end of our podcast, what can we expect for Beef 27? What's new on the horizon? A lot of our listeners are going to be there. What can they look forward to? What's the sell, Simon?
We'll have some new pavilions. We're bringing tech, it was last time, up the back a bit. We're building more of a precinct around what's new. So that will certainly be a big focus. We're also looking at how do we really give everybody a feel of the literal nose to tail. So there's a whole lot of stuff out there that's made out of beef that not everybody knows about. We'll be certainly looking at things like that. We'll be changing the dining experience a little bit and trying to, whereas since 2015 we've had a celebrity chef program, which was wonderful, but didn't. Well, to be honest, you end up with the chef as the hero, and what we want is the meat.
Yes.
To be the hero, I want the beef. So we're changing some stuff there, so hopefully we can expose more people to that absolutely top-class Australian beef. We'll rejig the entertainment part of it again a little bit to make it a bit more approachable. We want people to have a good time. But much of it last time worked pretty well, and so I think we will hopefully build on that. And one of the things, I went to Agribition last year, and when they do their presentation at their Supreme Champion, it's a bit more of an occasion. So we're looking at how, now when I say that, there's a lot more people watching at Beef Australia. Like when you see all those stands full when the interbreed's on, but how do we make that a bit more special?
Yes, right.
Not that I ever think jumping 3 feet in the air and smacking the winner on the rump is going to particularly work with some of the boss industry. You may have a really good look at the top story about Pavel's double story hocker, but
little quicker flight time, perhaps.
Yes, indeed. And I think that'll be good. So we're trying to have evolution rather than revolution. And 21 and 21 brought cattle from the other side of the road back in. I think the cattle precinct worked pretty well.
Yep.
Last time, so we're just looking at how to enhance that experience.
That's excellent. And you'll have your mandatory Brahmin hump, I guess, as well. Yeah. Very famous.
Yeah, getting along with his smoker again. So, yeah, that'd be good. I think that's just another example of how you can try something different. It was interesting. Linda and I had a holiday in France, and we went to Sommet de l'Élevage, which is the big cattle show over there. And there were no cattle because they had lumpy skin. So the French have a very definitive way of dealing with it to get it, they shoot them all. And so people weren't going to bring their prize stud stock to that. But there was like an Albrecht restaurant, a Charolais one, a Simmental one. So the breeds actually demonstrated the different characteristics of the breed. And it's a little different over there. I always reckon French butchers cut up a beast blindfolded at midnight because there's nothing you can ever recognise as what women see as a normal cut out here. Like you do tend to get a lump of beef, but it's nice. But yeah, I think that how do we demonstrate the nuance between that breed? And maybe it's less important here too because you get back. Well, from Angus' point of view, the Angus herd, which I think now is 50% of the Australian cattle herd, is extensively an Angus or bits thereof. So as I think people's expectations of flavour and tenderness have really gone up, and I think demonstrating that, how do we manage to demonstrate that?
Okay.
As growing up as
you can possibly be
the same, there was... When I was first working in Brisbane as the mail boy at Estates, the Bricky Creek had channel country bullocks, and that was their big thing. So the six-year-old bullocks, yellow fat, medicine the inside of the feedlot, and you don't get cattle like that. No. And they were uneconomic, and you could do it first. They just lived out there, and you ran them in, tipped the horns and put them on a cow wagon. But it's a bit different now, and I think that improvement in quality. I always remember Jason Strong a couple of years ago when he was head of MLA saying, everybody's saying, isn't it wonderful, you know, that beef prices are now starting to really reflect the value in it. And he said, it's not an accident. It's been 13 years of working with genetics, breed plan, MSA standards, improvement in meatworks, improvement in transportation, all those things. And yeah, everybody was, oh, we're lucky. Lucky, but it's not. It's actually the culmination of a long bit of work. The effort that people like your members have been putting in to replan and all that stuff is now starting to be appreciated and recognised. And I think that always means you're going to get an economic return.
No, there's some really good insights there, Simon. Thank you. Just before we close, if you're looking over the fence, you live in a Boss Indicus part of the world, a lot of composites up here, and Angus is part of that composite mix. If you look over the fence at Angus, I do like to ask our guests, what do you see? Is there something we're missing that we should be looking at? Is there some learnings for our Angus producing members, seed stock, commercial, otherwise? What's a bit of good advice from Simon Irwin?
And right, never planned for it to be good. No, I think Angus, when I think of Angus, there are two breeds of cattle in Australia that you can order in a restaurant, and that would be Angus and Wagyu. And I think the job that Angus have done about creating it as not just a breed, but as a brand, has been really spectacular. And I really admire the way that's done. You were kind enough to give me some minutes to speak a couple of years back at Tamworth at the Angus conference, and I couldn't believe how technical it was. This isn't people wandering out in the morning and having a scratch and deciding to, do a guess. It was the science behind the breeding and that sort of thing. It was just really impressive. And again, having some time at the Angus Forum in Brisbane, and I think what you're doing is just fantastic.
Thanks, Simon. Yeah, listeners will they'll enjoy this conversation. It's been great to spend a bit of time together this morning. As always, we enjoy each other's company. We console each other at times with running complex organisations, but really great to have you on the Angus table today, Simon, and certainly we wish you all the best success leading up to what I guess is a very intense 18 months ahead.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you and all your members come out there to see them. And if you are up and you're wandering around, say hello, because we'd love to do it. And as you say, we've got that great connection with Wendy on the board. So.
No, great, Simon. And and our members, we thank you, and you're very approachable, and I'm sure a lot of our members actually know you, so it'll be, and you're always accommodating to the Angus breed. We appreciate it, Simon, and look forward to participating in 2027.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.